Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The idea that birds are not particularly smart is so culturally ingrained that we refer to someone who is not intelligent as bird-brained. But researchers have found that birds are actually incredibly smart and have some abilities that far surpass that of humans. The Clark Nutcracker can hide as many as 30,000 seeds over dozens of square miles and remember several months later where it put them. Mockingbirds and thrashers can store up to 2,000 different songs in a brain 1,000 times smaller than ours, and the New Caledonian crow makes its own tools. This morning we talk with Jennifer Ackerman, author of The Genius of Birds, about birds' impressive skills and behaviors, many which resemble attributes that we usually reserve for humans. Jennifer, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So why did birds get such a bad rap about having tiny brains and being thought to have very little brain power at all?
Well, really, for decades, we assumed that a bird's behavior was driven pretty much solely by instinct. It had a brain, you know, that was so small and so primitive that it was capable of only the very simplest mental processes. But really, over the past several years, we've come to realize birds are a lot smarter than we thought, and their brains, you know, although they're arranged differently from ours, are capable of some very sophisticated mental skills.
Well, it seems that from your book that even though birds' brains are quite different from ours, they have kind of like equivalent or parallel functions. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about some ways in which birds' brains, despite the differences, actually resemble the functions of human brains.
Yes, they do. So while birds don't have a cortex like ours, you know, with neurons arranged in layers the way ours are, they do have neurons that resemble ours, very much the same. Cell, and they're organized into clusters like the clove and the garlic bulb. But it turns out that they share very similar nerve circuits, pathways between brain regions that our brains possess. They possess some very similar kind of brain regions, especially where language is concerned. And their brain cells use the same chemical neurotransmitters to signal between the cells that we use.
Well, I'm thinking about a lot of the bird behavior that we get to watch and how it really reflects amazing skills that I think in many ways humans don't have. But when we think about, you know, mammals that are intelligent, for instance, and I guess a rat is a very intelligent mammal, so we think. But I'm just thinking about the difference between a bird's nest and a rat's nest. And I wanted to sort of talk about what it takes for a bird to build those nests and the different styles of nests and how this indicates the artistry of birds.
Yes. We used to think that that nest making was in fact a pretty much a hardwired skill, but it turns out not to be that way at all. There's learning involved. There's experienced birds get better at nest building over time, and some of the studies are very very interesting indeed. You know, there's a team of scientists that studied zebra finches and learned that they were choosing better nesting material based on experience. And so the more nest building experience they gained, the more they chose the better building materials. What we used to think was instinctive behavior actually involves learning and memory. It involves experience, decision-making, coordination, and oftentimes collaboration between male and female, which is in itself a cognitively demanding effort.
Well, one of the things that struck me in your book is you describe how birds learn and that there's a lot of equivalence between the ways that humans learn and the ways that birds learn. So what are some of those comparisons?
Well, one of them is very striking, and it involves vocal learning. So Darwin called bird song the nearest analogy to human language, and he was really right. There are remarkable similarities between song learning in birds and human speech learning. Everything from the process of imitating, listening, imitating, and practicing, right on down to the brain structures that are involved in learning and the action of specific genes. So birds have a period of vocalizing that's equivalent to our baby babbling. It's known as subsong. And their song learning crystallizes their brain structure in a way that's similar to the learning in our own brain.
So actually, when a bird is learning how to sing, it's also developing brain cells. Is that true?
it's developing pathways, links between brain cells. So there are pathways that it's developing that are strengthened and crystallized through this learning process.
So would you say that there's a real strong equivalent in the process, that in the way that birds learn, whether it's they're learning how to sing or they're learning how to build nests or they're learning other behavior that is going to help them survive, and the ways that humans learn, and both physiologically and cognitively?
Yes, I think so. I think that's one of the reasons that scientists are finding that, for instance, the relationship between songbird tutors and their students is a beautiful system for studying the brain mechanisms that underlie our own learning of speech and language. So because of these similarities, birds are really a terrific model for studying human kinds of learning, especially where language is concerned.
So how does a bird learn how to sing?
Well, very much the way we learn how to speak. So it usually has a tutor, which is oftentimes its father, and it sits and listens, and then it starts to imitate, and it practices a lot. So when birds start out, they're wobbly in their singing, but they work at it, and by the time the process is complete, they are really masterful at singing the songs of their species.
Now, are there like birds that are like Pavarotti's, and maybe other birds that are more like Tom Waits, or what's the range of singing?
Big range of bird singing. There's the sort of melancholy chortle of a bluebird, which is very simple, and then there's some very complicated, wonderful songs of the thrush and a mockingbird, which sings many, many different songs, imitates bird song, is very precise in its singing and impressive in its imitative skills.
Well, actually, the mockingbird's interesting. I didn't realize until I read your book that the mockingbird wasn't just mocking other birds. I mean, I liked your analogy describing a mockingbird was kind of like when it would sing another bird's song was like Bette Midler singing the Andrew Sisters.
Right. So there's some tremendous precision in their imitation. And scientists studied the imitative skills of a mockingbird, and they found that when it sings, for instance, a cardinal song, it actually mimics the muscular patterns that the cardinal uses when it sings its own song. And it does very clever things, like if the notes of the bird that it's imitating fall outside its normal song range, it substitutes other notes or omits them, but lengthens other notes to match the song in duration. So it's this very sophisticated mastery of other bird songs.
So why do mockingbirds sing other bird songs?
Well, this is a bit of a puzzle. One theory suggests that it's showing the female bird that it's smart, it learns well, it has this great repertoire of songs, and that means that it will be a good mate, both in terms of its genes and its cognitive skills. So the large repertoire can hold cachet for the female.
Are there other reasons that birds sing besides for courting?
They sing to preserve their territory. Sometimes they sing, it seems, just for their own enjoyment. There's some very interesting studies about birdsong in the fall, and you know they're not defending territories then, they're not nesting territories, they're not courting mates, but they're singing nonetheless. And the thought is that this song, well sung, produces some pleasure chemicals in the brain that so it actually feels good to sing.
So they sing for the same reason we do, basically.
Right, they sing in the shower anyway.
So why do birds sing the whole, like the morning chorus of birds? What is that about? And why do they again start to sing just before sunset?
Well, so the big time of singing is the dawn chorus. And again, scientists are still trying to sort out why that is such a common time for so many birds to sing at once. And they believe that it may be related to the way that sound carries in the morning. But it's one of those really astonishing phenomena, I think, that I love to wake up in the morning and just hear the cacophony of bird song.
But I'm really curious. I mean, because one of the things that strikes me, it's if one has had a hard night sleeping and you're still awake and the bird chorus starts, which around these parts here in Oregon, it's starting to be about 5:30 in the morning. It's both reassuring and it's also like, oh my God, I really haven't fallen asleep yet. But that's when I listen to the bird chorus, it's kind of, it takes me out of my own, whatever keeping me from sleeping, and puts me in this other magical world. And I just wonder what is going on when they're all singing. I mean, are they singing to each other? Are they defining their territory? Are they just singing because they're happy the sun has risen?
I think they're mostly singing to attract a mate and to defend their territory.
So not quite, the other romantic reasons aren't quite there.
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that. But
Well, one of the things that's interesting, you seem to have a great affinity for chickadees, which I share. And you talk a bunch about their calls. And I listen to chickadees almost every day when I'm out walking and there's a lot of chickadees in our yard. And I didn't know the difference between the chickadee-dee-dee and the phoebe. And one of the things that was very interesting was the relationship between what they're singing and what they're saying, and that actually the chickadee-dee-dee has to do with predators being around. I wonder if you can expand a little bit about that.
Yes, this is one of, I have to say the chickadee is one of my favorite birds. It's tremendously intelligent and bold and innovative, a really wonderful bird. One of its amazing capacities is its communication system. So scientists have studied the whistles and the D's and all the gargle calls of a chickadee, and they believe that it's one of the most sophisticated and exacting communication systems of any land animal on the planet. So when you pass a chickadee, just take note of the number of D's at the end of its call, because they are conveying to other chickadees your size and the degree of threat that you represent. So the interesting thing is that humans generally are not considered a great threat. It's the small, agile predators like sparrowhawks and Cooper's hawks and those kinds of birds that merit a lot of D's, because they're a bigger threat to the birds.
Yeah, I notice that they only do about two or three D's when I walk by. I'm trying to remember when I used to let my cats out, which they no longer come out anymore, how many D's they would do in the backyard when the cats were around. Probably quite a few more.
I would think so.
Well, I'm going to throw out a question to you, which you might not have thought of. This is not covered in your book, but I was putting my garden in last week, and I was serenaded by eagles like the whole time I was planting my vegetables. And it was quite pleasant. There were three eagles, as it turned out, flying in a circle over my head. And they had this amazing song, which sounds like a songbird. And I wonder if you know anything about what produces that sound and what they're doing, why they come up with that sound. At other times, they make much more of a raptor sound, of kind of sound. So why do they sing this songbird-like song sometimes, and they make their more raptor sounds at other times?
Oh, that's fascinating. I do not know the answer to that question, but I would love to learn. If anybody's listening who can answer that question, that's very interesting. I didn't realize that eagles had those two kinds of calls.
We probably have more eagles in our area than you have back in Virginia, actually. But
well, they're starting to come back, but yeah, they're pretty rare around here.
I mean, they're actually, I see sometimes not quite as many eagles as I see robins, but there's a lot of eagles in my neighborhood. And I didn't know that they had that bird, that songbird sound, until it was, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. I was walking through the park and I looked up, I heard the sound, I look up, and at the top of this blue spruce, there's this eagle standing perched at the top, singing its brains out. And it was really astonishing. And then I started noticing that, because I'd heard that sound before, I realized it was always the eagles that were making that song.
And how wonderful.
And I hope that somebody knows out there why eagles sometimes sing like songbirds. The other sound that they make, and I've seen it when they're swooping for prey, they make the much more kind of familiar predator sound that sounds more like a hawk.
But right. That's the one I'm familiar with. And the osprey around here has that cue call, which is more of the predator's call.
Actually, the osprey here, they also do this dee, dee, dee kind of sound. And it sounds like a very slowed down flicker sound. So it's fascinating to me how many different calls birds have. Like, and I've discovered this as I watch birds over the years, and I've learned most of my bird calls from actually seeing the bird in the tree making a sound and going, oh, that's where it came from. So I got distracted here by a question that we will get to later, but that it's interesting again, like, you know, why like flickers have a whole variety of sounds that they make. And I'm wondering if you're familiar at all, if you thought about the songs and the sounds of woodpeckers.
Yes, so I don't know very much about the woodpecker calls, but except that they have not only their calls, but they have drumming is in their repertoire and actually can be used as a communication tool as well.
I mean, the drumming when they're thumping on a tree?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's partly about drilling a hole for an insect, but it's also a communication tool. So I, you know, we have ciliates around here and flickers and I hear their calls all the time, and also their drumming, which is apparently communicating more than we thought.
Well, it's amazing that ciliated woodpeckers, I mean, they sound like a jackhammer.
They do.
And it was really astonishing the first time I saw them. And that we're having more and more pileated in our neighborhood as well because of this wildlife refuge that's there. And I was really astounded when the first time I saw one actually pounding on a tree, and you could hear it from all the way across the park. It was quite an experience. The flickers have a much more of a dull-sounding, thuddy-sounding thump, it sounds, than the pileateds.
You know, that one of the interesting things about woodpeckers is that there's a kind of scale that scientists use of, it's kind of the equivalent of an IQ scale for birds. It's an intelligence scale based on innovative behavior. And woodpeckers rate very high on that scale. So they are thought to be very intelligent. That the scale is based on innovative behaviors in the wild. So birds doing new things to solve old problems or solving new problems, but doing things that are innovative and creative. And apparently woodpeckers are rate very high on that scale.
And that's why there's a downy woodpecker pecking at the telephone pole outside my house every day now, which the flicker's also been hanging out there. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jennifer Ackerman, who's author of The Genius of Birds, and we are learning just about that. So as we... we could talk about bird call all the time, but as you're talking about innovative behavior and flexibility, let's move on to birds making tools. And the famous story is the Caledonian crows, the new Caledonian crows, who are very famous for their tool making. But let's talk a bit about that. But I also am curious if other birds besides the Caledonian crows also make tools.
Yes. Yeah, so the new Caledonian crow is the most famous the tool-making birds. There are others. The Goffin's cockatoo makes tools. And oddly enough, woodpecker finches of the Galapagos make tools. So these are both island birds. That's one of the things they have in common. The Goffin's lives on the archipelago of islands in Indonesia. And as I said, the woodpecker finch lives in the Galapagos. But by far the most talented toolmaker is the new Caledonian crow. It's the only species other than humans to make hook tools, and it really rivals the big primate toolmakers like chimps and orangutans for the complexity of its tools. And these are sophisticated tools to get at hard to get at food, and they have different styles of toolmaking in different parts of the island. Which of New Caledonia, where they live, only place on the planet they live. And these different styles of toolmaking are passed down over generations. So this is a kind of culture, the faithful transmission of tool design.
So you talk about, again, like the way that birds learn to sing from their parents. How do they learn how to make tools?
Well, it's a process, and it's there's a long section of the book about a young New Caledonian crow learning from its mother how to make a tool. And it is a very slow process. It's like watching a baby learn to use a spoon. And it takes, many months into years for a New Caledonian crow to really learn how to make a good tool. But it does so by imitating its parent and trying things out itself. And there's a wonderful video of this young New Caledonian crow trying to make this tool and trying to use it, and it gets everything upside down and backwards until it's really much older and can make a good tool itself.
Well, you mentioned that these birds live on islands. What does it, living on an island have to do with a bird's ability to make tools?
Well, that's somewhat of a mystery. One of the ideas is that there are few predators on islands. So for instance, a New Caledonian crow, a young one, can noodle around with tools and learn to make them well over a long period of time without worrying about being snatched up by a hawk or some other kind of predator. Weird things happen on islands. You know, they're isolated. This particular island, New Caledonia, has some very rich food source. It grubs inside holes in trees, and it doesn't have any woodpeckers. So the New Caledonian crow discovered that this, you know, was a rich food source, but how to get at it without the skills of a woodpecker. It evolved the use of tools.
So it's kind of like human beings not being able to kill their prey the same way that wolves or grizzly bears could, but we make our tools, we make clubs or whatever, up to guns and high-powered rifles to do things. So it's the same kind of thing.
Right.
Well, it seemed like some of the tools that the crows make are really complicated. They're not just like a little stick that's bent. How do they go about making these tools, and what do they look like?
So one of the fanciest tools they make is made from a pandanus leaf, and it's hooked on one side, has little spines along one side. And the bird tears this leaf in a very specific way, and it ends up with a step-down serration. It looks like a little hand bar or something, but and the spines are along the edge that the bird uses as the tool. So it's used to wheedle out grubs and other invertebrates from these hard-to-get places. One of the ways that they learned that the birds have different styles of making this tool in different parts of the island is that when they carve out this tool from the leaf, it leaves the negative imprint of that tool on the pandanus leaf, so that scientists could go around and say, so that this is the way they're making it in this part of the island, and they're making it in a different way in another part of the island.
So are these tools things that they make and then throw away, or are these tools that they carry around in a tool belt?
It is remarkable. Some of the birds do actually keep and reuse these tools. So if they make a good one, they'll hang on to it.
I mean, you read that in the book. How do they hang on to it? They fly around with these tools in their beaks, or what do they do?
Yeah, they stash it in a place they know they can find it again.
Which gets us to another thing. Let's talk about the ability of Clark's nutcrackers and other birds to stash all kinds of food in many, many different ways and remember where all that food is being kept.
Yes, I think this example of spatial smarts really stands out for its sheer amazement. The Clark's nutcracker is a Western bird with a spatial memory that just far exceeds our own. It lives in the mountains, and it caches tens of thousands of seeds every year in thousands of different caches. And then it remembers where it stashed them with incredible precision, even though those locations where it buried its stashes may be underneath snow or shifting rock and soil. The bird can recover those caches months later. And it's just mind-boggling.
So how do they do that? Or do we know?
Well, not exactly clear, but they do know that olfactory smell plays no part. They're not sniffing out their caches. The going theory is that they create a kind of mental map of the tall landmarks around them, around the caches, trees and rocks, things that won't get buried by snow or shifting soil. And then they somehow register and remember those locations the locations of where they buried their caches relative to these big landmarks. And they, you know, they can do things like triangulate them, and you know, it's just staggering that they can recall thousands of these kinds of locations. But you know, I can't even remember where I put my keys.
So they kind of like have a built-in GPS of sorts.
Yes, I think it remains to be seen. These pine seeds that they bury are just minute. So the bird digs for it with its little bill, and it has to be very targeted in its the location that it's digging. And if it even a little bit to one side or the other, they may never find the cache. But scientists have studied it in about 70% of the cases. Clark's Nutcracker finds its particular stashes.
Well, the other, I mean, it sort of relates to birds' other amazing ability, which is to navigate huge distances, particularly thinking about migrating birds. And I mean, whether it's the Arctic tern that migrates from Arctic to the Antarctic or other birds that migrate almost as far. Let's talk a little bit about this uncanny ability to travel long distances and know where they're going, and compare that to you not being able to find your keys.
Yes, or find my way around a small patch of woodland. It is an amazing thing. I'm in awe of the navigational abilities of birds. And it's one of the great mysteries. We've discovered a fair amount of information, a lot of it by studying migratory birds and also pigeons. But and one thing that we've learned is that birds probably navigate using a kind of two-step map and compass strategy. So first they determine where they are at the point of release or where they're leaving from and which way they need to travel to get home. So that's the map step. And it's kind of like in our spatial coordinate system, it says, okay, I'm south of home, so I need to travel north. And then they use landmarks, celestial cues, environmental direction cues, like magnetic cues, as a compass to keep them on the straight and narrow path to their destination. But the whole system, including both map and compass, appears to consist of lots of different elements with different kinds of information: sun, stars, magnetic fields, landscape features, wind, weather, maybe even smells.
So these are things that they store in their brain. I mean, you describe it like having a map and compass, but this is all mental. They don't actually have a map and compass. And I'm just
wondering
what the equivalent would be. I when I was reading your book, I was thinking about the ways that I've learned my way around the woods and the way I learned my way around cities. And over time, I mean, the first time I go out on a hike, I'm not going to remember every landmark, but there's hikes that I've taken many, many times, and I remember specific trees now. So is it that kind of thing where they're just a much faster learner than I am, that they like observe all these different landmarks and then they're able to hold them in their memory and come back and recall it when they're on the same route again?
Right. And it's called true navigation, and it seems to be the result of something called cognitive integration. So they are able to integrate information about distances, landmarks, spatial relations, memories, like you described, sights, sounds, and smells, and they all funnel into the kind of core of important brain regions. And then the information is called the connective core, and there it's integrated, and then it fans out to the brain regions that help guide the bird to where it's going. Really, it's astonishing.
So one of the experiments you described, which I found rather disconcerting, is that scientists like have captured birds as they're about to migrate and trucked them or flew them 3,000 miles east and set them free and saw how many were able to get back on course. I mean, I have two issues about that. One is what it shows about the bird, but the other one is what does it show about people to do something like that to a bird?
Well, they're trying to understand this phenomenon of true migration, true navigation, and it's a tricky thing to study, and the one of the best ways of studying it is through what they call a displacement experiment. So the experiment you're talking about was with the white-throated sparrow, and it was a group of scientists plucked this little flock of sparrows from their migratory path on the West Coast, and they were transported these birds were transported by jet 3,000 miles across the country to New Jersey. And then they were released, and within hours, those sparrows were beelining solo back to where they'd been heading originally, their wintering grounds in Southern California and Mexico. And this was true even for the young ones who had only made the migratory journey once. They knew somehow just where to go and how to get there. And, you know, without the help of any GPS, and I just don't know many humans who would pass that test.
So did every bird make it back to their winter quarters?
Not all of them, but most of them did.
Now, I was a little concerned about the ethics of this, and I guess there's that and some of the other experiments where they sever certain parts of their body. And I just wonder about your take on that. I mean, you write about this rather neutrally, and I was reading it with a certain amount of horror, and I just wonder what your take is on the kinds of experiments they do on birds, and if it's really justified to find out these things about that we're interested to know about, both their mental processes and our own.
Yes, I hear you, and it is a really unfortunate thing. There's just a lot of sacrificing of birds in the study of animal behavior and animal cognition, and it's difficult. But I don't know how else that science will progress without some of these experiments.
Because it seems like they wouldn't experiment on primates like that anymore. I mean, they used to, and then we have a primate center not far from here. But there's a lot of ethical issues about what kinds of experiments you do on primates and on other mammals. But it seems like birds are still like that much far away from us that we can kind of mutilate them to learn interesting things about them.
Yes, and that may change. I mean, I think the understanding and attitude toward birds is changing radically, and it will be interesting to see whether that has an impact on guidelines for experimentation.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jennifer Ackerman, who's author of The Genius of Birds, which is a book that will let you know about the inside workings of birds and their amazing abilities and things you probably have never considered before, unless you listened to my interviews with John Marzo a few years ago when we talked about the gifts of the crow. And I when I started reading your book, I thought, well, how redundant is this going to be? And I thought, well, you do make some references to Marzo's book and to some of his findings, but you went off in so many directions that he probably never even imagined, because he was focusing so much on crows in the Northwest, that it's really been a mind opener to me to learn some of the things about birds. And I want to get now to the bird that amazed me the most and I knew the least about, which is the bowerbird. And I wonder if you can talk about the bowerbird's amazing behavior.
Yes. The bowerbird is the artist of the bird world, and there are several species of bowerbirds, most of them in Australia and New Guinea. They live in rainforests and woodlands, and they have an extraordinary capacity for building and design. They build bowers to draw in a female mate. These are not nests. They're display platforms, really. And, for instance, the satin bowerbird makes two perfectly symmetrical little walls. It's an arch that he makes with these very slender, straight sticks. And he builds a beautiful little arch for the female to stand in. And then he lays sticks out around on the floor around this, or the ground around this little archway. And he decorates that platform, that floor, with ornaments. And in the satin bowerbird's case, it's blue ornaments. He's very, very bullish on blue. But every bowerbird has different favorites. There's a species called the spotted bowerbird, which uses more of a combination of ornaments. And one of my favorite examples of a spotted bowerbird's bower was a bird that located its bower near the studio of a stained glass artist, and the bird had plucked little shards of colored glass from the garbage around this studio and had arranged them by color in this lovely mosaic on its bower floor. So there's something very, very interesting going on here. The creation of these visual displays, but then also the bowerbirds do use their platforms for song and dance. So they are combining all the arts in an effort to woo the female.
So they not only build this beautiful set, stage set, basically, and then they perform on it?
Yes. Yes, they do this. They're also mimicking birds. So they mimic different species, and they do this little, it's very aggressive dance. It looks it could be an aggressive display, but it's really meant to show off to the female. And the really good bowers, the beautiful bowers that are very symmetrical and have lots of bling, lots of blue objects, in the case of the satin bowerbird, those males are the ones that get the mating. So not all of the male bowerbirds get to mate, but only the ones that the females say, this is an excellent bower and a great display, so I'll mate with this guy.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned also with songbirds, it seems like the critic ability of the females who are listening to the songs of the songbirds, the male songbirds, and the same with the bowerbirds, like they shape the aesthetic of their species, so to speak.
Right. It's a very interesting idea that females are really shaping these artistic displays, and they're also possibly shaping the cognitive capacities of the males, because they're using these traits as an indicator of a male's quality and selecting for it by choosing to mate with him. So to the extent that's important to a female, she's choosing these cognitively capable males and therefore, probably shaping better displays.
Well, one last thing I want to talk about is the adaptation that some birds have to human environment. And you talk about the house or the English sparrow. So I wanted to go out by talking a little bit about that and what that has to reflect on us as we move into the Anthropocene.
Yes, so the house sparrow is a tremendously adaptable bird, has a genius for adapting to human environments. And I think it's a question about how we might be shaping the bird family tree by, first of all, destroying habitats and also creating these very urban habitats. So our urban environments really favor species that are flexible in their eating and foraging habits, and they're willing to do new innovative things like blackbirds and sparrows. And, that's just a small part of the avian tree of life. There are also birds that are specialists, that they can only live in a very particular part of a rainforest or section of a mountain. And those birds are the ones that are really are suffering because of habitat change. I think it's one of those things that we have to ask ourselves, are we selecting for a certain kind of bird in the world? And don't we want to keep the widest swath of the avian tree of life that we can?
I've, in my time that I've lived in Portland, which is quite a bit of time now, I've watched the crows go from being basically farm birds to being largely city birds. But it's also been interesting to watch the peregrine falcons and the osprey and the eagles and hawks coming back to Portland. So it seems like it's not just the house sparrows that are like living close to people. I mean, the eagles don't live as close to, they're not like hanging out in the trees in my yard, but they are flying over my house now.
Yes, and it's true for a lot of birds. Ospreys, I know, are just seem unflappable in terms of where they nest now. They're in very populated places, it's a very particular kind of cognitive ability, that adaptability, and I think a human activity has caused the extinction of around 1,000 species so far. Many of them on islands, but it's because of habitat loss. But it is, one of those things that I think we have to work very hard to create refuges and places where these birds can continue.
Well, I could talk about birds with you forever, but I think our time is out now, so we have to let you go. But I want to thank you very much for joining us, Jennifer. It's been really good talking about you. I really enjoyed your book, and I wish you many happy hours of bird watching.
Oh, thank you so much, and the same to you.
Thank you. We've been talking this morning with Jennifer Ackerman, who's author of The Genius of Birds, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guests are Bill Bigelow and Tim Swinehart, both retired teachers in the Portland Public School, and they're authors of a comprehensive climate change curriculum, which they're pressing the Portland Public School District to adopt. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
I took a house by the water, took a man on a mountainside. Corina, Corina.